Continuing with Alec Little on 8 March 78.
Well, we just, as I was saying, that we just finished matching the whole thing up, ready to leave it going for the night, and the car was sort of getting ready to go, and poor old Sati tripped over the transmission line and pulled the whole lot down. So we had those sort of problems occasionally. Poor old Sati, we never forgot that.
But those sort of things were easy to recover from.
Oh, yeah, sure, just minor things. There was no basic problems with it, I believe. It worked first off.
And so what was the next step then?
Well, then the next step was to design a bigger one, Fleur's instrument.
And what fundamentally had to be different about a big one?
Well, the actual method of phase changing was the main problem, because this model one, we had to actually go along and change taps on a transmission line, and of course you couldn't do that if you were going to have hundreds of dipoles, which we did have finally. And this one, you see, there was only, I've forgotten how many dipoles, and not many. So it was possible to change the numbers, change the phase quite easily to steer the beam, but for a big instrument it had to be designed. So we did some prototype work on this, actually, on a feed system, which doesn't appear on this diagram, on that photograph. But,
and so what method did you come up with?
Well, we had this system of a transmission line with taps at every 30 degrees of phase, I think it was. And that meant that you could then come along with a capacity, since the whole thing was such a large number of dipoles, and each dipole is only coupled to the transmission line fairly lightly, so that it allowed you to then move the tapping point of each one into any one of the holes nearby, so that it gave you a possible phase error of plus or minus 15 degrees, which we thought was adequate in there.
But you still went along and manually did this?
Yes, that's right. So each day when you set the beam up for a night's observation, you had to go along and change all these taps, and you went along with a little card that told you which hole to put it in.
Mm-hmm. And how long did that take us, out of curiosity, to do that?
About half an hour or so to actually
change. That would just be the north-south arm, of course.
Yes, right. We did have some phasing on the east-west arm, but it was simple phasing to look either in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. So we'd look always in the north for a while and then always in the south.
You were observing at night to avoid interference?
Oh, it was a convenient way of doing it. We did a lot of engineering during the day, and then we'd set it all up for the night and then go home and come back the next morning.
And it was very convenient.
Very convenient, yes.
The sky came around over a year.
Right, yes. Well, obviously, we would have had to do something different.
That's interesting. But still, you were at a pretty low frequency. Interference was no problem at all?
Not at that stage, no. At 85 megahertz, it wasn't really much of a problem. The main problem from interference in those days was light aircraft, which in those days weren't suppressed, and they'd come and fly around over the top of the blooming thing.
Because it was such a curiosity,
right? This thing, put, 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 and the number of times that it would come over right on when a source was going through the beam, it was incredible.
You probably felt like setting up batteries on there.
Well, we eventually got some protection, and if they did this persistently, we'd try and get their number and ring up the aircraft, the airport, and tell them they shouldn't be there.
Uh-huh. So that was built over a period of a year or two, I suppose.
Yes, a couple of years, I think.
You were designed, once again, concerned with both the aerial and receiver?
No, the receiver was mostly Kevin Sheridan's responsibility.
That's right, he told me.
Kevin
that.
Was, yes,
right.
Kevin was the electronics, and I was the outside stuff, and the aerial.
He produced a marvelous photograph of you pulling Flo, the truck.
Did he? I see, yeah. Yes, that used to happen quite often. Actually, we didn't use Flo much. Flo was mostly for Alec Shane's benefit. The later 30 megacycles.
Well, everyone was in pulling.
Oh, yes, everybody was using Flow.
Now, from that, of course, came many small projects as well as the major survey, and you were co-author on many of these things.
Sure.
Were you involved in the scientific interpretation of the data at all?
Mostly not.
And so it was mainly Mills making the decisions as to what was going to be looked at.
Yes, that's right, yes. He was the group leader, and Kevin and I were, and Bruce Lee, of course.
Right.
Bruce actually had more of an astronomical interest, actually, than probably Kevin or I did in those days.
So once it was working, was there sufficient need for constant maintenance and improvement here and there that you kept working on it?
No, I think by that time, the thing was working more or less continuously. I gradually went off the project, and I think that was about the time that Twiss arrived. And
what year would that be, roughly?
Well, that would be about 56, I guess, mm-hmm. When I joined Twiss. I can tell you more precisely again by looking at the notebooks.
Okay, and then what did you do with him?
Well, then Joe Porte had asked Richard to undertake a survey of sources, angular sizes, at 1400 megahertz, using some of the crisscross solar array.
I see.
Our intention was to use the four aerial technique. If you take a pair of aerials on one end of the baseline, another pair on the other end, and you correlate the whole four of them, you can in fact get the phase and amplitude of the components of the Fourier transform of the source relative to the original spacing without having to worry about calibrations. And this is a very good technique. So we started off to do that, but before we did that, Richard managed to persuade Joe Porte that he'd like to finish to do an experiment on the photon correlation experiment. Because there was still some controversy at that stage, Richard really wanted to try this, and I was helping him on the technical side of that.
That was done in
radio physics. Yeah,
I see.
That's the time coincidence experiment. It was done in the radio physics lab.
Well, I'd forgotten that he was experimentally inclined. I was always thinking of him as a pure theorist.
Yeah. He's a good theorist. I don't know whether you could call him a good experimenter. He certainly needs technical help.
Right. But he's interested
but
in
he's very
doing
interested
experiments
in doing
and so
experiments,
on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he was interested in this particular experiment because it was vital to
and of course,
set us
well,
an
he
argument.
Had developed a theory with Henry Brown, of
right,
course.
Right, yes.
Let me just go back yet another step now to this idea to look at radio sources with the crisscross.
Right, yes.
I don't believe I ever remember any publications from that.
Was that the Twist, Carp, and Little thing. That's this over here. It came out much later, actually.
It came out in 1960
yes.
in the observatory.
Yes, it was
and
much
you looked
later.
At the
Centaurus,
forward bright sources.
The bright sources, yes. And in fact, this was a bit of a bit sad in a way that the publication of that was long delayed because, in fact, we did have information about the fact that Centaurus was double.
Hmm.
In that record, I believe, which came out much later.
Hmm. Interesting.
And that was after I'd been at Stanford and discovered it there as well.
So the observations were done some 3 years
yes, yes.
Before.
So I left radio physics in 1958 to go to Stanford, and the observations had been completed by then.
All right, now going back to... okay, that was the Twiss experiment. Now,
yes, that was the Twiss experiment.
Now, the one he did in the laboratory, what did it establish, and what were you trying to get at?
The photon thing?
Yes.
Oh, well, this was to show that, in fact, if you did the coincidence by photon counting, in fact, there is a correlation between the arrival time of photons at two separate photon multipliers.
Right.
The previous one, the thing that had been done in England, of course, was the CW experiment, using the CW nature of light. This is the photon, using the photon.
And some people have said that this absolutely could not happen.
It couldn't happen.
Quantum mechanics and so forth.
And we were able to show after a dint of many hours of sweat and sitting in the dark and horrible things that in fact that there was time correlation of photons.
And did that settle the matter pretty much?
I think so, yes. I don't think there's been much argument ever since. That was sort of done in collaboration by remote control with Hanbury, of course, too. I mean, Hanbury was...
he was still in England,
still
that's
in England
right.
at that yeah. stage, yes. But Richard used to correspond regularly with Hanbury.
But Porte was willing to allow this sort of thing to be done?
Yes. I think
different.
He was getting a bit fractious towards the end because we were having a bit of trouble getting it to work. And, you know, I think he was almost ready to switch it off when we actually got it going properly.
I guess the next thing was that you went to Stanford.
Right, yes.
Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, at the time that I went, the 1958, Hefner and Wade, I guess, I'm not quite sure who were the first people to show it, but they had developed the parametric amplifier and established the fact that you could, in fact, produce low noise amplification at microwave frequencies. And Joe thought it'd be an opportunity for me, first of all, to get some overseas experience and also to get some first-hand knowledge of parametric amplifiers for the lab.
And, thinking of the Parkes dish, you think?
Well, yes, I think so. I think so. In general, you know, low-noise amplifiers are always a great interest, of course, to radio astronomy. And Bracewell, being at Stanford, made the thing a lot easier because Bracewell was prepared to support me at Stanford. And this was leave without absence. Leave absence without pay. And of course, I had to arrange to get a research associateship at Stanford. And Bracewell was prepared to support me half time. And Heffen was there along, Hubert Heffen. And so I went there too.
Well, these people that developed the parents, which department were they in?
The electrical engineering department at Stanford. And that's where Ron is, of course, Ron Bracewell, mm-hmm. the electrical engineering department. It's Heffner and Wade were the two people that were working on those in those days.
And what did you learn at Stanford?
Oh, I learned a lot. Well, I was able to persuade them to let me take courses there too. Of course, by this time I'd completed a degree at the University of New South Wales, so I had a BSc, but... they let me do courses towards a higher degree in electrical engineering, mm-hmm. and I took a master's, although I didn't actually have time to ever get around to doing a PhD.
Mm-hmm. But you were concentrating on learning about receivers.
Right. Well, I was working essentially with parametric amplifiers, and then sort of towards the end, in order to justify Ron's help to me, I tried to develop a low-noise parametric for use on his array. Dave Cutterbeck was trying to do some temperature measurements on the moon. Mm-hmm. They certainly could have used more sensitivity because the array was basically a solar array in those days.
It was existing already.
It was existing, yes. Yeah, sure. And it was mainly used on the sun, and Dave was trying to use it on the moon, where the sensitivity wasn't all that bright. And we developed a parametric amplifier for the use on that, and then I did some work with the brighter sources again, doing some distribution of radio energy across some of the brighter sources.
This was not. Was this apparent for each dish?
Or? No, this was that was a sort of a hope that we might have got around to, but it actually never eventuated. We made one first, and they were fairly expensive things in those days, and a bit dicey sort of things to make.
Right. So just a single one.
Yes, a single one to put in front of the whole thing.
You also had an article here that you gave at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, a talk apparently on masers and paramps.
Well, parametrics, not masers.
The abstract said masers. Comparing, maybe you were just comparing them.
Yes, could be. It was never published, I don't think. So it's only an abstract.
Yeah, just the abstract,
just
right.
Yes, yeah. There were several other papers that were published, one or two other papers published on parametrics. There was a super-regenerative operation of parametrics, for example, that was published there.
Mm-hmm.
Not very long papers.
The paramps in those days, or parametrics, were certainly the lowest noise figure.
Sure.
Except for the masers.
Except for the masers, yes.
But the masers, what were the main disadvantages?
The fact that you had to operate them in liquid helium was basically the problem, and they weren't always easy. You couldn't easily make them at any frequency in those days. It's a bit easier now. It's still difficult.
Yeah.
Parametrics, you could. You could make mm-hmm. them work at any frequency.
And what sort of improvement were you getting now? Here you had a 1.8 dB noise figure. What was typical for a crystal mixer?
Oh, crystal mixer about 6 dB or so. Although they had traveling wave tubes, and I can't remember what they were. They were about 4.5 dB, I think, something like that in those days.
So it was really quite an improvement.
It was, yes. Yeah.
Mm. But nevertheless, they didn't take... Well, when did they take over, would you say? Yes.
I can remember Hanbury coming to visit us while we were at Stanford, and he described trying to get a parametric going as like trying to stand a needle on its end, and I think he was pretty right. So that's about the state of the art as they were in those days. It wasn't really until, I suppose, in the last 10 years, really, that
late
they're
60s,
now sort of, yes, yeah. Westerbork, I think, probably was, that's not fair. I mean, they used them at Jodrell. Commercial ones, and so the late 60s.
They had them in NRL and NREO,
sure,
in
yeah.
the late 60s.
There were commercial, AIL and,
right.
And Ferranti right. in England and other places were making them.
Those
early ones were all handmade things, and Brian Robinson, I think, developed some for
right.
one for
But the difficulty was basically instability?
Yeah, yeah, the gain instability was the problem, really. And, you know, if you tried to put dicky switches and so on in front of them, then, of course, you lost some of the advantage of it, because the dicky switches weren't all that good either in those days. And the idea of cooling them, the idea of cooling them was around, but they still were pretty awful things to try and cool in those days.
But you could use liquid nitrogen or something that's more easily handled than liquid helium.
Right, yes. Yeah. Mm. But, you know, they're still not a nice device. I mean, we've got four at FLIRS, which was one of my responsibilities in my connection with FLIRS to keep them going. And, they're commercial ones, but they've got to be kept in a constant temperature environment mm-hmm. and things like
yes.
that. Messy.
Let's see. Just looking at your other papers, we haven't talked about the lunar occultation experiment that you did with Rishbeth.
Yes, that was it was almost a shambles, that was.
In what sense?
Oh, well, it was a special experiment. Of course, we had the FLIRS thing, you see, and we couldn't change the beam position easily. So we had arranged for a whole group of people to come out and plug in the things
stationed
at the appropriate moment, you see. And that was all right, that was fine. But we were watching the record, and the record was gradually going down and down, you see, and we're all saying, oh, gee, look at that, you know, look at that tremendous drop, you see, and unfortunately it kept on going down. Right at the critical moment, bloody mains regulator was packing up. It was failing. We managed to recover it in time, but it did make a bit of a shambles of observation.
But you were able to establish it was a pretty large source.
Well, again, this was really Rishbeth's project. He mm-hmm. was a PhD student with us at that stage.
Well, then you came back from Stanford. And
well, while I was at Stanford, I had intended, of course, to come back to CSIRO.
Right.
And, but at that stage, Bernard had, by this time, had joined the university. And Harry Messel came over on a trip and saw me and offered me a position in the university, which I accepted, and I've been here ever since with the Molonglo telescope.
And when you came back to Australia, what year was that?
That was 61.
61, you began immediately working on aspects of Molonglo.
Yes, sure.
And that's, of course, still going, and you were just telling me that, in fact, it's going to be
used changed.
At 800 megahertz as an Earth rotation synthesis telescope. Well, I think that covers it pretty much, unless there's...
No,
well,
that's
I'd like to ask you a question
sure.
as to, in the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
Someone asked you, what do you do? What did you answer? What is your profession?
In the late 50s?
Yes.
Well, I tried to tell them that I was a radio astronomer, and that I worked in,
term radio astronomer.
Yeah, I think so. Perhaps I didn't. Perhaps I would be more inclined to say I studied the radio waves coming from outside the Earth. That was probably more to the point, perhaps, but not radio astronomy. You're quite right. I can't remember when that term would have been first used.
Earlier, but most people didn't actually use to describe themselves.
Right, no, I think that's probably right, actually. I would have said that that's what I did.
Well, and the other thing I would ask you about is the overall success of radio physics, especially for the... period before 1960, to what do you think it should be ascribed?
The success of it?
Yes.
Well, I think it had a lot of factors. Most of the people that went into the radio astronomy field were fairly skilled engineers. Mills, for example, was mm-hmm. a very good engineer, and they had been working on radar, so they had a lot of the radio techniques readily available. So the experiments were not all that difficult to do. I mean, there was a lot of things to be discovered with fairly straightforward, simple equipment. But the direction, I suppose, really was something that I couldn't really assess, because I was never involved with any of the high-level planning of the direction mm-hmm. of the radio astronomy research. So I really wouldn't be capable
the
of
policy and,
saying what the policy was, whether it was Joe or Taffy, for example.
Yeah.
I know Joe was always terribly enthusiastic about things, and he used to come out and watch me, you know, see what I was doing. He while the FLIRS era was being built, Mills was in America, and Joe used to have Kevin and Bruce and myself along to meetings regularly to see what we were doing, and he'd come out every now and again, and I can remember seeing him now sort of standing out in the sun with a knotted handkerchief on his head there. Doing some aerial measurements with mm-hmm. me just to see whether I was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But he was certainly enthusiastic, and whether he was the main driving force behind the direction, I don't know.
What about the thing that Ruby Payne Scott mentioned to me about that the workshop was really an excellent one? And
well, it was. It was. I mean, the whole facilities of radio physics in those days was extremely good. The workshop were all very cooperative and all very keen to do things, and there was never any real problem. That you could almost get anything done very quickly in the workshop. It was always a great deal of help. Yes, it does.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.